each of any other provision of this act. One of the significant improvements over the current law is the extensive changes provided for in the bill in the area of corporate stock and distributions relating to stock. The bill eliminates the concepts of par value. You can still have par value, but you don't have to have par value. It eliminates the concepts of par value, stated capital, capital surplus, earned surplus, and treasury shares, which served only to complicate legal capital calculations and which were based not on economics but only on history. The test for dividend, redemption, and other distributions to shareholders are made more uniform and are based upon whether after the distribution of the corporation, the corporation would be able to pay its debts as they come due and would be able to satisfy preferential rights to other shareholders if the corporation were dissolved immediately following the distribution. I just say as an aside, this is an area in corporate law, the stated capital, capital surplus, that many lawyers never understood, that didn't make any logical sense, and this new model act language achieves what which I don't believe was achieved under the former act, and that is that logical test. If you're going to pay a dividend or if you're going to redeem stock, is this corporation going to be solvent after you complete that transaction? And it's said in a lot simpler terms that we all can understand. The bill adds a judicial procedure for removal of directors in the event of fraudulent or dishonest conduct or gross abuse authority. The bill establishes a standard of conduct for officers, which is not present in the current law. The bill allows certain housekeeping amendments to articles of incorporation to be filed without shareholder vote. The provisions in regard to mergers and exchanges are similar to current law. The provisions in regard to the sale of assets are similar to current law, with the exception that the bill provides that a mortgage or pledge of substantially all of the assets of the corporation outside the ordinary course of business may be undertaken by the board of directors without a shareholder vote. The dissolution procedure is substantially revised to provide that the articles of dissolution are filed at the commencement of the liquidation proceedings and not at the conclusion.
Yes, Representative Schoon.
Stuart, would you rather we wait till you get through to ask questions?
Either way.
Okay, well, I've got a question, Madam Chairman, on the section where you said the bill provides that a mortgage or pledge of substantially all of the assets of the corporation. And then my question is, outside the ordinary course of business, may be undertaken by the board of directors of a shareholder vote. And I guess I've got a question why that would be permitted as an ordinary act if it's outside the ordinary course of business, and if it has a way of encumbering the, or it implies that the business is being encumbered in a way that maybe shouldn't be.
Well, I don't know that it, no, I don't think it implies, the intent is not to imply that it was being encumbered in the way it shouldn't be. This is Model Act language, and the comments of the Model Act say that it was the writer's belief that current law is frequently violated unknowingly in this area. That still doesn't relieve the directors of their duty of care. It still doesn't. It's got to be a valid transaction. It cannot be an illegal transaction. It has to, there, you know, obviously it would have to be a mortgage for consideration and things such as that. It has been a real potential trap for the unwary. The problem you always run into in the practice of law is when does this transaction, when we're refinancing this business, is this out of the ordinary course of business or is it in the ordinary course of business? The drafters of the Model Act and our task force concurred that there were sufficient other protections in the statute and that in fact this was a trap for the unwary.
Thank you.
The dissolution procedure, as I said, is substantially revised to provide that articles of dissolution are filed at the commencement of the proceedings instead of at the end. And this is really just a mechanical thing. As a result of this mechanical change, there are new procedures for dealing with identified and unknown claims against the corporation, which will be very helpful in the dissolution of a corporation. In other words, that there is a procedure somewhat similar to probate, would be the analogous situation, where if there are known claims, you require those claimants to make the claims to the corporation, and so that you can ascertain what your liabilities are out there. The provisions in regard to foreign corporations are substantially similar to current law, with the exception that certificates are eliminated here as elsewhere in the bill. And this, again, is for the purpose of simplifying the corporation division's procedures. The only need for a certificate is to have something to frame on your wall, is my experience. The shareholders' rights to inspect documents are better defined and more logical, as well as providing against the possibility of abuse. We do ask that the Act be amended by deleting Section 67.4, since Oregon has a comparable provision in ORS 20.105. I have and attached to my testimony is a copy of our proposed amendment, which is also consistent with the proposed amendments of Legislative Council, of which I got a copy of immediately prior to the hearing. And in fact, we have reviewed all of the proposed amendments of Legislative Council, and they all appear to be in order. Finally, that large stack of documents which I handed to you included the official amended comments to the Act and the extensive committee report in regard to the Act. Basically, the committee report is a section-by-section comparison of the Act with present Oregon law, or where it digresses from present Oregon law, and with the Model Act and where it digresses from the Model Act. And we've given you that just for purposes of legislative history. And, of course, that the official comments are also for purposes of legislative history. In conclusion, Senate Bill 303 will make it simpler for a small, closely held corporation of the type which I represent to engage in business in the state of Oregon, and will make it simpler for a large, publicly held corporation to be incorporated and engage in business in the state of Oregon. I have not walked through section by section of the bill, but I have basically hit the significant highlights. There is only one other change which I probably should comment on, and that is that under our current Act, preemptive rights are automatically provided for shareholders unless the Articles of Incorporation provide otherwise. Under this Act, shareholder preemptive rights are only provided for if the Articles of Incorporation specifically provide for preemptive rights. The Act also contains a grandfather clause that protects shareholders who, as of the date of execution of this Act, have preemptive rights. So other than the fact that you will now have to put those in your articles if you want them, there is really no substantive impact on shareholders as a result of that change. So other than that, that concludes my testimony. I'd be happy to answer any questions which you might have.
I'll hold them from now for myself. The gentleman wants to go forward.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Gary Byrne, and I'm an attorney in Portland. And my firm is, I'm a partner in a firm called Stoll & Stoll. And we often represent small investors and minority shareholders and, you know, the little guy in corporate disputes and in securities cases. And partly because we weren't as attentive as we should have been, and partly because the bill was on a fast track, lawyers who typically represent investors and minority shareholders, I don't think, really looked at this that closely until recently. And I appreciate the attention that we've gotten from Representative Jolin and Senator Hill and members of their staff for a couple concerns that we have. And I also appreciate the attention that the task force has given our concerns. And they're supporting this amendment to delete Section 67-4. And we think this is a very important change in the bill, or in the Senate bill. What it does is it eliminates a provision that would have given attorney fees to only defendants in the stockholder derivative cases. It would not have given attorney fees to a successful plaintiff in a case like that. And we believe it would have changed the Oregon law, which is currently in 20.105, and that this change does not affect the meat of the bill and the important parts of the bill, which are to make Oregon more hospitable to business and to make the bill more administratively workable and that sort of thing. And the change that we propose and that the task force now proposes to delete Section 67-4 would make the Oregon law consistent in that respect with Delaware law, and I think with the law of every other state of which we're aware. And we're here in case the committee has questions about that change that we propose. I think I can say that it's fair to say I've talked with other lawyers who typically represent small investors, and they would also support this change because of the quick way that the bill was moving. We couldn't, you know, get a lot of people down here immediately to give you their comments, but I think that the small investor would be in favor of this change.
Just a comment, because so many things happen more or less behind the scenes, sometimes more than less. Since last Friday, when I had a conversation with Gary, I have talked to more people than maybe I care to, but there is complete approval of this particular amendment. Any comments or questions? George?
I have one for
Representative
Stuart,
Gilman.
If we're through.
You betcha.
Yeah. First of all, Stuart, thank you very much for all the time you've spent. We appreciate it. This bill probably doesn't change this at all, but in corporation scenes these days, we find unfriendly takeovers fairly often. And I'm not even that familiar on how well our old laws took care of that or didn't take care of it. Does this really change anything from the prior laws as to unfriendly takeovers from other corporations?
I should say that with this caveat, Representative Gilman, that as I said in my testimony, I represent small, closely held corporations and do not represent publicly held companies. I do not think that this act, although there may be something in there that would give somebody some aid, I do not think that it significantly or substantively makes any changes in that area.
Representative Peterson. Thank you. Couple questions, and maybe directed to you, Stuart. In your testimony, you talked about the bill allowing certain housekeeping amendments concerning articles of incorporation. It would help me if I could envision just exactly what one of those might be. Just a real life. I recently incorporated my business. So
basically, and I'm looking back to Peggy Noto, who was also a task force member, for a little help in this area. It's a voluminous act. It basically would be in areas where under the articles of incorporation, there have been certain parameters that have been set up for. I believe one of the areas is to establish certain types of preferred stock, and if the directors do establish that stock offering consistent with the previous established parameters, then they could go in and amend the articles of incorporation to reflect that there is another class of stock that the corporation can issue.
And right now they would have to go through the shareholders.
They'd have to go through the shareholders. I think what I'm saying is that most of these would be used at the publicly held corporation level, not at the type of corporation you and I are familiar with, and truly are housekeeping amendments. For example, the ability to delete from the articles of incorporation, the names and addresses of the initial directors, things like that. Okay, just
minor.
Just cleaning things up, nothing substantive.
Representative Schoon.
We've heard quite a bit about Delaware today, but South Dakota seems to be the hot spot. Did you compare the corporate laws there also by chance?
No, we didn't. If we did, it was inadvertent. I don't recollect South Dakota coming up in any of our discussions. We did, basically what we did is I guess we worked kind of in a vacuum, maybe a little provincial, but we really sat down and what we did is we took the Model Act in one hand and the current Oregon Act in the other hand, and we just hammered it out section by section. There were certain, there were times when we hit certain areas where we'd say, hey, I think maybe Delaware or some other states got something that could help us in this area, and then we'd go out and look at it. We never took the Delaware Act, for instance, set it down and worked directly from it, other than, and I think maybe only one or two sections that we really dealt with. We made a real effort, and our real goal was to make this workable for Oregon and make it an Oregon Act.
And that's good.
Thank you.
Thank you all very much.
Thanks for all your hard work.
Thank you.
Yes, indeed. Hal Stoltzman. Tom and I cannot. It's Mentor Graphics Corporation. And also Frank, it looks like from the same corporate interest. Would you all come down? How do you pronounce that?
Probably my name is Bruguer.
Bruguer. Is that French or what?
That's a very long story.
Okay, let's not get into it. Let's just talk about Senegal real quick. Okay. Tom, would you like to start?
Oh, sure. Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tom Bruguer. I am the President and Chief Executive Officer of Mentor Graphics Corporation, which is located in Beaverton, Oregon. I'm here along with Frank Delia on my left, who's our Vice President and General Counsel and Secretary of the company. And we're here to testify in behalf of our company in favor of Senate Bill 303. And we'd like to focus on one particular aspect of the bill in speaking in favor of that bill, and that is the director's liability provisions that are in the bill. First, just a brief statement about Mentor Graphics so you'll have a little perspective as to where it is we're coming from. Our company was founded in 1981. We're a high technology company, about 6 years old. We've grown from a few people in a very small office space with three card tables and three folding chairs and a blackboard that leaned against the wall to $175 million in sales during the last year. We've grown from where back in 1981 we lived off what we affectionately called the Memorial Fund, which comprised our savings, and we called it the Memorial Fund because when it ran out it will be a memorial to us all, to where we have raised over $120 million in public and private money in order to grow our company to the size that we are. We have about 1,000 employees worldwide. About 600 of those are actually in Oregon, and we have a payroll in Oregon of somewhere over $20 million annually, so I'd place us in the medium scale range of companies. We are actually now the second largest electronics company in the state. What we have found is that the overall corporate governance system really depends very much on the mechanisms of self-governing for the outside directors of the company, and requires them to provide independent, objective oversight of what management, myself and the rest of management of the company, is doing in reaching reasoned business decisions. Throughout the growth of our company, we have relied to a great deal on the advice and counsel of our outside directors, and without that advice and counsel, we would not have been able to grow as fast or has been as successful as we've been. However, we now find that we are at risk in retaining our current outside directors and in attracting new outside directors because of what is happening in the overall liability arena out there. Because of the substantial judgments that have been rendered against directors in the courts in recent years, and because of the ever-increasing premiums for directors and officers' liability insurance, which have just skyrocketed out of sight. Frank will touch on those in a second. We find that directors are now requiring some kind of protection from personal liability. As it sits now, a director that is making decisions in good faith for what's best for a company like Mentor Graphics can be held personally liable. That is, that individual's personal assets are put at risk for making a decision that is in the best interest of the company. That makes it very difficult to attract and motivate someone to be involved on the board of directors of a public company such as Mentor Graphics. If we feel that if competent directors are not willing to serve because there's an unreasonable risk of exposure on their personal assets, then the whole policy of having outside directors as independent counsel goes out the window. And as a result, the oversight provision that directors provide in companies goes away. And we think that that's a mistake. We think that directors should be able to make complex decisions in an environment that's ever-changing, but they should be able to do that in such a way that they don't feel that they have an enormous cloud hanging over their head that's about to come down and punish them simply because they've tried their best. We think that for a company like ours and for other high technology companies and for public companies in general, that timid decision making is particularly bad as we begin to grow and compete against foreign countries and companies. Last year, in response to the overwhelming concern that our directors have in the personal risk to themselves and to future directors that we'd like to add, we voted to reincorporate Mentor Graphics in Delaware, and we are currently in the process of implementing that plan. In a very few number of days, we will have a proxy statement going out to our shareholders requesting permission to reincorporate Mentor Graphics in Delaware. That has been drafted and is scheduled to go to the printer in about a week or 10 days, I believe. From our point of view, we think that that's very distasteful, and personally that breaks my heart to see us having worked so long and so hard to create an Oregon company and build an Oregon company, now being faced to move that incorporation out of the state to Delaware because of the what we believe is antiquated corporation law in this state. We have been very supportive of Senate Bill 303 because we believe that Senate Bill 303 provides a mechanism whereby the corporation law in the state of Oregon once again makes it attractive for a company to be an Oregon corporation. And as a result, we are waiting with bated breath to see exactly what comes of the bill, because it will determine whether or not we have to go to Delaware or can stay in Oregon. It would go very much against our grain and against our culture to have to move out of the state, to move our incorporation out of the state, and to reincorporate in a different state. However, in the long run, we have to do what is best for the company. That's our fiduciary responsibility. And what we believe is in the best interest of the company is to be able to attract and retain high-quality, qualified directors. And as a result, we will have to implement the path that we have gone down. I believe very strongly that other corporations in Oregon are struggling with the same problem. Some are not as openly speaking about it as we are. And I believe that they're coming to the same conclusions. I know that some of the high technology companies in the state that share directors with us, for example, are facing the same kinds of issues. We believe strongly, in conclusion, that Senate Bill 303 does represent a chance for the Oregon legislature to send a very strong pro-business message out from Oregon. And we urge very much that you pass it, allow the boards of directors of Oregon corporations to get on with our business of giving good advice to the companies and growing good, strong, profitable, healthy Oregon companies.
Thank you. Are there any questions? If not, Mr. Delia, would you like to add anything?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. As Tom said, I'm Frank Delia, Vice President, General Counsel of Mentor Graphics. And I'm also here on behalf of Mentor Graphics to urge you to adopt Senate Bill 303. As Tom also stated, our main concern is the effect of the liability situation on the quality of corporate governance and the ability of companies to attract and retain outside members of its board of directors. In addition, as a lawyer in the state of Oregon, I would also like to be able to practice under the most up-to-date and current corporate law available, and I think that Senate Bill 303 we'll do both of these things, both allay our concerns about director liability and modernize the corporate law practice in the state. In performing their duties, directors of a corporation are obligated as fiduciaries to exercise their business judgment and act in what they reasonably determine in good faith, after appropriate consideration, to be in the best interest of the corporation and its shareholders. Traditionally, under what is called the business judgment rule, directors were not liable to the corporation or its shareholders for such decisions, assuming they acted in accordance with their duties of care and loyalty, even if the consequences turned out to be disadvantageous to the corporation. Recently, while purporting to respect the business judgment rule, certain courts have recently subjected directors to enormous personal liability by determining that the manner in which the directors reached their business judgment decisions was inadequate. For this and other reasons, legal proceedings against directors relating to their decisions as directors have significantly increased in number, cost of defense, and level of damages claimed. Whether or not such proceedings are meritorious, the cost of defense can be well beyond the personal resources of directors. Directors and officers' liability insurance, so-called D&O insurance, has traditionally provided protection to directors involved in those kinds of proceedings by covering the expenses of litigation, judgments, and amounts paid in settlement in a wide range of situations. However, at the same time that the director's exposure has been increased because of this litigation, past levels of D&O insurance have become either unavailable or available only with dramatically increased premiums. I would cite you the example of Mentor Graphics in particular. In 1984, when we first went public, we were able to get D&O insurance. Our policy had an aggregate limit of liability of $20 million. This was subject to certain retentions and exclusions, and it cost us approximately $20,000 to get it. After an extensive effort in 1986, we again obtained a D&O policy with liability coverage of $10 million, or half of what we had in 1984, but at a cost of approximately $225,000, 10 times as much. And I might add, subject to higher retentions with regard to the company and additional or more extensive exclusions. This increased exposure to litigation costs and the risk and the reduced availability of insurance coverage have made service as a director of a public company considerably less attractive to experienced, qualified individuals. Potential personal liability and related expenses far exceed any reward, monetary or other, an individual can expect to receive as a member of a board of directors. As Tom has said, we believe that to continue to attract and retain qualified directors, the company must take action to reduce this personal risk of directors. The board believes, and the management of the company believes, that directors are motivated to exercise due care in managing the company's affairs, primarily by a concern for the best interests of the company and its shareholders. What we fear is that increased exposure to personal liability may, instead of benefiting the company through increased director responsibility, lead to overcautious decision-making that will ultimately impair corporate governance. We've heard from others what SB 303 will do for the corporate law. In particular, we think that the liability limiting provision covering directors is very important. I can only add to what's been said, but the particular concerns of Mentor Graphics in that we are in the, as Tom said, getting ready to go out to our shareholders to.
The legislation is very specific in defining what constitutes a lemon vehicle and what the consumer's recovery should be. With this specific language, informal arbitration should be all that is needed in order for the consumer to recover. Has the promise of the lemon law been fulfilled? It is our opinion that it has not. After over 3 years of the law being in effect, not one auto manufacturer has established an arbitration mechanism in accordance with lemon law standards. Title 16, Code of Federal Regulations, Part 703, known as the Magnuson-Moss Regulations, govern compulsory arbitration mechanisms, which the consumer is required to use before going to court. These federal regulations were indexed in the current lemon law statute. The intent of the lemon law is that if manufacturers provide arbitration panels, these panels should substantially comply with Magnuson-Moss. There are four primary arbitration mechanisms in Oregon, which hear new vehicle complaints. Chrysler has the Chrysler Customer Satisfaction Board. Ford has the Ford Consumer Appeals Board. General Motors, American Motors, Volkswagen, and several imports use the Better Business Bureau's auto line. A number of other foreign automakers use AutoCap, a program set up by automobile dealers. The Chrysler, Ford, and Better Business Bureau panels are compulsory mechanisms and so fall within the scope of the lemon law. By contrast, AutoCap is a voluntary mechanism and is not bound by the lemon law. Osberg's recent report, The Lemon Lawbreakers, which I believe I distributed to the members yesterday, documents the case studies of 21 Oregonians who attempted to press legitimate lemon law complaints only to not be awarded recovery as called for in the current law. For example, 73-year-old Marcielle Miserac of Ashland had her Oldsmobile Cutlass Sierra in repair 20 times. After going through arbitration twice, she has been given only additional repair attempts and her car still does not function properly. Roland Lovely of Portland had the engine on his 1985 Ford Thunderbird repaired 8 times. As a result of arbitration, he received only an extended warranty. Perhaps the most extreme example documented in the study is that of Arlene Eagleston of Hillsboro. Her 1985 Plymouth Reliant was repaired 64 times. Chrysler never even notified her of her arbitration hearing. These are just three examples of Oregon consumers who have attempted to use available arbitration mechanisms only to find that these panels do not conform to existing law, do not provide for consumer recovery as called for, and worse, completely ignore the law. Another problem is lemon owners who do not have access to any sort of arbitration panels. For example, the 1985 Subaru station wagon owned by Ginny Gerlitz of Tualatin was in the shop for over 60 days. Subaru refused to do anything about her lemon. Since that automaker does not participate in arbitration, she had no recourse and was forced to trade in her lemon vehicle. Oregon consumers are currently in a bind. On the one hand, they must rely on arbitration panels which do not meet accepted standards. On the other hand, the lemon law does not currently provide for recovery of attorney fees and costs. This makes it very difficult for the consumer to secure an attorney willing to take the case without having to pay out substantial sums of money up front. Since Representative Jolin went through the provisions of the measure, I'll forego that. Osberg would respectfully request one amendment. I believe you have before you amendments drawn up by Legislative Council in the form of House Bill 2599-1. We believe that these amendments satisfy some concerns that we've heard from the various interest groups involved in this process, and we believe that the addition of the dash one amendments would make the overall bill more acceptable and a better overall bill. And just in closing, Madam Chair and members, the legislature should build on the lemon law to ensure that it works for Oregon consumers. Thank you very much, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
One thing I think we both neglected to say, John, with all due respect, this also expands the law to rentals.
or leased, rather.
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Automobiles, and that should be noted.
That's correct. I'm sorry. That's correct. That should be noted.
You probably followed my
good
lead,
point.
Right? Representative Ekus and then Representative Schoon.
Excuse me, I may have missed something because I had to step away for a minute. But why doesn't the Chrysler Ford the four primary arbitration mechanisms in Oregon, which hear the new vehicle complaints, explain to me again why they don't come under the Lemon Law?
Right. Madam Chair, Representative Ekus, it was the feeling in 1983 that automakers should not be forced to implement any sort of arbitration mechanism. The language in these existing statutes states that if manufacturers provide arbitration for new car disputes, then those arbitration panels should substantially comply with the federal code, 16 federal code part 703, which is indexed in the current statute. The problem we're seeing, and which we believe we've documented in our report, is that after over 3 years of the law being in effect, we have not seen those three major arbitration mechanisms move to be in substantial compliance with the federal regulations.
So the ones that are set up, the national companies, Chrysler, Ford, those, even though they have an arbitration mechanism, it's not, it doesn't comply with the federal regulations?
Madam Chair, Representative Ekus says correct.
The Fed said.
Madam Chair, Representative Ekus, again, it's our understanding that, there are no national Lemon Law standards. There is, Lemon Laws are an entity of the states, and in fact, 41 states today have some sort of Lemon Law. It was the intent and indeed the desire in 1983 that I guess those of us who went through hours of negotiations working out the exact form of this bill, it was our intent and certainly our hope that the automakers would comply with the federal regulations. We're disappointed that they haven't.
Representative Schoon, then Representative Peterson.
John, can you give us some figures on how many cases there are in Oregon maybe that are brought under this and how many were successfully or unsuccessfully resolved?
Madam Chair, Representative Schoon, unfortunately I cannot give you those figures simply because those are not a matter of public information. One of the provisions in the House Bill 2599 would in fact open up that process to review by the Department of Justice. We think that that's an important element because I cannot give you good information today as exactly how many, what percentage of consumers are or are not awarded under the Lemon Law simply because we don't have access to that information.
Representative Peterson.
Yes, I was just trying to follow exactly what your amendments do, and I see they're fairly minor. We've added some language about safety. Can you tell me, John, what the rest of the amendments do?
Sure. Madam Chair, Representative Peterson. First on the safety amendments. In 1983, that was the original language that we proposed in 1983. That is language that's consistent with some of the other Lemon Laws, Connecticut, Massachusetts, for example, which are on a national level some of the stronger Lemon Laws in the nation. We unfortunately in 1983, due to various political considerations, had to give up some of that language. We feel it's important that we add it now. The other part of the -1 amendments simply changed the language in Section 4 of House Bill 2599 Yes, Section 4 of House Bill 20599. As you currently have the bill before you, Section 4 would mandate that arbitration panels submit records on a case-by-case basis to the Department of Justice. What the Dash 1 amendments simply do is to say that the arbitration panel shall keep records, and if those records are requested by the Department of Justice, at that point, should the Department of Justice request those records, then they shall be turned over.
Thank you.
Any further comments or questions? Thank you very much. Representative Trahern, come on down.
Thank you, Madam Chair. May I bring my resident expert?
I suppose we'll allow that.
Which hot seat do you want?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I was going to explain the word expert for you to start with. X being past tense, and spurt being a drip under pressure. So,
and who does that apply to?
May I address the committee, Madam Chair?
It's good.
For the record, I'm Rich Keister, and being the luck of the Irish, you know, I now have Representative George Trahern as one of my paid members, being a new car dealer in Grants Pass.
For the record, Madam Chair, Representative George Trahern, District 49, we have... First of all, I would like to commend you for the bill. Think that it has a few other issues that need to be addressed and have presented to you, and I hope you have in front of you Legislative Council House Bill 2599-2, proposed amendments. And I would like to address those for just a moment if I could. As those are being passed out, Madam Chair, the amendments, just from listening to the Dash 1 amendments, I don't believe would be in conflict with the Dash 1 amendments. I've not seen the Dash 1 amendments, so I'm not sure of that, but I didn't hear anything that we were conflicting with in particular with those, but rather we would look at these as addressing a slightly different issue with the Lemon Law. I might start by running through those with you. The first part of the amendment on the Dash 2, you'll note, starts on line 19. And that's really a restatement of the current statute, clarifying that the manufacturer has at least one last opportunity, if you will, to collect the alleged defect. The second amendment starts on line 24. And it says basically that there is nothing to create a cause of action against the dealer by the consumer. Section 7, paragraph 2, section 7 being a new section from these amendments, and I think this is the most critical part, because it's a hold harmless clause, so that the manufacturer cannot charge back to the dealer the cost of settlements that they may make in arbitration. Now, the Attorney General will argue that if this language is here, there's no incentive for the dealer to do proper warranty work, including maybe even fraudulently submitting warranty claims or whatever. But I would point out to you that the manufacturer has audit authority over each and every one of the dealers. And they can charge back to the dealer any time they choose, and almost at will, or deny warranty claims as they see fit. So the dealer is required and is audited to be sure that he is abiding by their procedures manual. I think it's obvious, and is that all of you are customers, and every dealer, including the volume folks, are looking for repeat customers. The key is the fact that if a vehicle is purchased by a dealer, and that's what we do, if we purchase the vehicle and it's later identified as a lemon because of the arbitration process, there is no reason really for the dealer to pay for it twice. After all, the dealer bought the lemon, made three or four or five or six or however many attempts to correct a problem and the defects. Then the manufacturer again had the opportunity to correct that and couldn't do it either. So the consumer then goes through the arbitration process. And there's nothing so bad about that. But the arbitrators award them either dollars or a new car. There's no reason for the manufacturer then to charge that back to the dealer on the vehicle that the dealer didn't manufacture, but rather only sold as a middle person, if you will. And that's the concern that we're going to have.
Representative Peterson.
George, has that been a problem in other states? I mean, is that one of the reasons that you bring this up?
It's a concern.
Okay, it hasn't actually happened, but
I've not seen it. Perhaps Rich can tell more than I can on that.
Madam Chair, Rich Keister, Representative Peterson, I would just tell you that our National Association has alerted all the states to, when a lemon bill is introduced, to endeavor to stop that as a possibility. And I might just add that one of my members from Salem was here in the room for some time, thought that, was not aware of Senate Bill 303 going to be, had to leave. He would have been here to tell you that he's been threatened. And I might also point out to you, I have the privilege of reading some testimony that will be given to you later by a consumer. And one sentence in that testimony points out that one of the dealers in Portland was threatened by the manufacturer to be sued if he endeavored to help the consumer through the lemon law process. And it's that kind of activity that we're hoping to curtail by this amendment. I would also want to point out that we still have a contractual relationship with the manufacturer and a franchise agreement that requires that we do warranty work and do it properly. And they do have audit authority, and they do exercise that authority and charge back to the dealers anytime they feel that warranty work was not done properly. So,
Representative Schoon.
George, how would you anticipate the amendment on that begins on line 19 where the manufacturer has to receive written notification and then be given the opportunity to correct the defect? How would you expect that to work? And one of the reasons I'm asking is that I once wrote a manufacturer and didn't get anything back. Yeah. You know, they didn't even acknowledge that I'd written a letter, and so I just assumed that they probably have a process for handling letters like that that didn't include responding.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Schoon, that surprises me. I've been involved in this business for more years than I care to think about, I guess, some 35. And the fact is that even 20 or 30 years ago, with the manufacturer that I was working with at that time, or through the dealerships, they did respond. In the recent history, the manufacturers have become very, very concerned about consumer satisfaction, if you will.
This was quite a while ago.
It's become probably as important to us in our franchise as sales, and that may not mean a lot to some folks, but when we recognize that the manufacturer always measured their dealers on how many cars they sold, I mean, that was the bottom line, if you will, they now measure them equally on how many happy customers you got out there. And so what generally happens when the manufacturer receives a letter of that type is that they refer it back to the dealership, and hopefully the dealer then will, you know, contact you, take care of the problem. You may not hear directly, at least the first time, from the manufacturer, but they do tend to follow up on those, at least now they do.
How would the customer, the consumer, what would he be required to do to ensure that he notified the manufacturer? Would he have to send a certified letter or something like that just to ensure that he could prove that it was mailed and that the manufacturer actually did receive notification?
Madam Chair, Representative Schoon, I just in reading that from my perspective as, you know, as a customer that wanted to be sure the notification was sent and received, I would think that probably the safest answer for the customer's protection would be to send that with the return receipt or something. That we didn't write that in there and said it has to be, but that then gives you pretty solid proof that it was in fact received.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Jim Austin.
Madam Chairman, committee members, my name is Jim Austin. I represent the Motor Vehicle Manufacturers Association, which is the trade industry association for the domestic manufacturers. There's In discussing this bill and meeting with some of the proponents of it, as we did in 1983, I think there's some things that I'd like to point out just in brief retrospect. This type of a third-party arbitration program, informal dispute program, was created prior to any of the Lemon Laws that were implemented in the United States, because the industry and the manufacturers recognized the fact that there were some problems out there, and that there ought to be an expeditious system by which the consumer can get his problem, hopefully get his problem rectified. As we've heard in the past, and we're going to continue to hear in the future, there's going to be continued problems, I think, regardless of what type of program we have out there. It's not designed, nor is it in any way presented to be a panacea to the problem. But we are concerned about making the program work. And we've heard today, and we'll probably hear during the course of the hearing, that there are some problems and some people, situations and defects have not been handled correctly, and that'll probably continue to be the case. The question is, how do we go about resolving the problem? How do we go about improving the system and making it work better? As was pointed out, the Magnuson-Moss Federal Trade Commission Part 703 guidelines are just exactly that. They're guidelines for the informal dispute resolution process. The at the present time, the Federal Trade Commission has appointed an advisory committee, of which our industry and a number of consumer groups and others are participating in reevaluating this whole process to improve and upgrade the guidelines that exist. As I said, we're strongly interested in making the system work, and we're strongly interested in providing an expeditious process, because if the consumer has to go to court, it is a lengthy and sometimes an expensive process for them. But I think that there's some misconceptions that exist too, which is another area that has to be worked on, and that is that historically, as this program has evolved, the consumer has been made to understand that they really have two recourses. One is to receive a vehicle, or to be refunded the value of the vehicle that they purchased if it doesn't meet the guidelines. And this is not the case. So I think there's an educational process that's going to have to be improved upon. But the approach that we are concerned about in this bill, House Bill 2599, is that, as the chairman referred to, using a hammer. Well, it's a pretty good hammer, pretty big hammer. I guess the question is whether that is going to provide some solutions too, because the informal process is different from the legal procedures and the court process. And the court should make the determination if the third-party process had any problems with it, or if it wasn't handled properly, or if there was misrepresentations or any illegal activities that were done in the course of handling the consumer's complaint. Not only that, but we also feel that with the treble damages that are in the provision presently, that it really creates a misconception and an incentive to the consumer, possibly, to pursue, to go through the third-party mechanism and then pursue the their rights in court. So, in essence, there's the possibility of a $10,000 vehicle, for example, using that as an average cost of a vehicle, turning into a $30,000 award by the courts because of the additional provisions that are in a statute that deal with an informal process. So we have these are the primary areas that we have great concern with in this bill, and that being the attorney's fees, which I'm sure when a person goes to court, there's provisions in the UCC and other areas of your law that provide for attorney's fees. But in addition, the treble damages we feel are extremely punitive. I'll be glad to respond to any questions.
First, if I may, and you know, it's difficult to be angry at somebody when you're angry at something, and that makes absolutely no sense. But, you know, Jim, you're a nice guy, but your manufacturers haven't been very good to the public. They haven't been very responsive. And this is nothing I haven't discussed with you before. You say you're interested in improving the system. You're interested in making things work. You're strongly interested. I'm picking up on some of the words you've used. Well, why haven't you done it yet?
I don't know, Madam Chair, I don't know the number of annual sales of vehicles in Oregon, but I would imagine we're talking about 175 to 200,000 new vehicles sold in the state of Oregon a year. The program's been in existence for some three and a half years. If we take that situation and multiply it out, those numbers, and multiply it out, you're talking about roughly a half a million or so new vehicles have been sold in the state of Oregon since this program's been implemented. Along with that comes a number of warranty claims that are exercised or utilized and pursued by the consumer. But the fact that the consumer goes into the dealership or into multiple dealerships to, in some cases, to have a problem rectified doesn't mean that they've got a lemon vehicle or doesn't mean that they want to pursue the third party.
You're not answering my question.
My point is that there are a number of claims made, but what we're hearing about is several dozen very onerous results. Some being in the case, I guess, where they haven't even pursued the third party process. So there are a lot of cases out there, and I've requested from the different programs, the Chrysler program, the Ford program.
Jim, what process? Will you describe the process? Your words. What process?
I've requested from
Ford. What's your arbitration
Ford,
process?
Well, the Ford program or the Chrysler program, they all differ a little bit from each other.
Mm-hmm. And how many times have you utilized? I guess what I'd like to see is how many applications from the folks out there, the consumers out there, have been made to the manufacturers within the state of Oregon, and how many have been addressed, resolved, etc.
That's what I have requested, Madam Chairman, is the data, the history of the number of complaints that were filed, the number that were handled in mediation, those that went to arbitration, and the results of those cases. And I'll be glad to supply it to the committee.
Thank you. One other concern about something that you said, and using my words, heavy hammer, and I agree. I don't differ to Bicker at all. It is a heavy hammer. But you can really avoid that heavy hammer as long as through the preview and review from the AG's office prior to going to court, the AG's office, in accordance with this particular proposed law, would review the case and say these folks operated in good faith, they complied with the law, everything's hunky-dory. Or in fact, at least that's my intention in this bill, the AG's office could say, no, it doesn't.